We're finishing up our lessons on Genesis tonight. I want to encourage you to be sure to be back next Sunday night and encourage others as well that haven't been being with us for these studies in Genesis on Sunday night, that they come starting next Sunday. We'll start in the book of Matthew. And so we'll be studying the life of Christ. And if there's anything that Christians need to study, it's the life of Christ. So we'll be studying that in depth, looking at Him and His teachings and His life, His example that He gave us, and hopefully learning then how, as Christians ourselves, we should be living our lives in order to be more like Him and to please Him. As we conclude the book of Genesis tonight, we come, of course, the end of Jacob's life. At the end of the last chapter, he had said his final words, told the prophecy of the coming Messiah, whom he refers to as Shiloh, until Shiloh comes, and talked to them about what would happen to them in the future. Jacob, a bit of a prophet. Well, after Jacob's death, Joseph wept, kissed him. There's no mention of the other brothers doing that. Surely they loved their father. Perhaps they didn't have the relationship with him that Joseph had. Certainly they had not been separated from him for long, many years like Joseph had. So maybe it was a greater loss to him than it was to the others. But perhaps the Bible seems to be focusing on first Jacob and now Joseph, and it really doesn't spend a lot of time focusing on any of the other brothers. Back in chapter 38, there was the one incident of Judah and Tamar, and so there was that case that was explained, and because Judah was the tribe through which the Messiah is going to come. But the other brothers are kind of left out of the picture. There's not a lot of focus on them. So it's not surprising that since Joseph has been our key character here, of course we know God's the main character, but Joseph has been one of those key characters through these past several chapters, it's not surprising that it focuses on his actions at his father's death. Jacob, Israel, is embalmed by the Egyptians at Joseph's command, and of course it would have been very difficult for them to travel the long journey back to bury him. If you remember, he had made them promise at the end of that last chapter that they were going to take him back and bury him in that cave that Abraham had bought way back when to bury Sarah. And so he made them promise that. It certainly would have been a long trip back with his body if it hadn't been for the Egyptians' embalming process. I think we can be glad for some of the advancements, because in verse 3 we find that apparently the embalming process that the Egyptians used took about 40 days to complete. So, Craig, you want to start using the Egyptian method? It'd take you a while to get 40 days. That's a long time. And I don't know what they had to do to that body. I'm not an expert on Egyptian embalming. I don't even know that much about the embalming we use now. But I know 40 days is a long time. And that was quite a process. Well, in addition to that, it says that even the Egyptians mourned for Jacob for 70 days. You know, it is something that in our society today, when it comes to death, you know, we go to the funeral on Monday and we're back at work on Tuesday, and we think that that's the end of that and it's behind us and we've got to move on now. But grief doesn't work that way. Grief doesn't just disappear overnight or in 2 days. It doesn't work like that. The Egyptians mourned. And this was someone, this wasn't even one of the Egyptians. This wasn't even one of them. But it was Joseph's father. And they mourned for 70 days. It says a lot about the respect they had for Joseph. And the fact that they were willing to do that. Now, I don't know how far this mourning time, I don't know that that meant that they didn't do any work or anything, you know, they weren't off work probably for 70 days. But maybe it had to do with, you know, maybe they tied the black ribbon on their doorposts or something like that for 70 days for him as a memorial, as a reminder of his life. But after that time was over, Joseph asks Pharaoh for permission to go bury his father. He had been made to promise that. He had promised his father he would bury him back in Canaan. And so Joseph asked Pharaoh if he could go, and Pharaoh, of course, said yes. And Joseph promised that he'd come back after the funeral was over. And Pharaoh sends a whole crowd of people with Joseph to go along with him. Pharaoh's servants, the elders of Pharaoh's house, all the elders of Egypt went with Joseph, as well, of course, as Joseph's household and his brothers, and all of Jacob's household all went as well. It says they left their little ones and their animals, their livestock, there in Goshen. They didn't take the little children. And certainly, they surely left some adults to care for those little children. They didn't just abandon little 2- and 3-year-olds for several weeks while they went off to another land and back. That certainly wouldn't have been the way it worked, but there's no mention of those nursemaids that they left behind for the little ones, but they surely left someone to watch them. But the family, those that were old enough, and when it says little ones, I don't know how little a little one is. You know, is a 15-year-old a little one? Is a 10-year-old a little one? Is a 5-year-old? At what point they took them and at what point they left them behind, it doesn't say. But they did leave some of the younger children. Well, this large group winds up going all the way to Canaan, and they take chariots and horses. Would have been quite a sight, I'm sure, to see all of these traveling. When they got to the other side of the Jordan River, they mourned there for another 7 days. And then they buried Jacob there. The Canaanites called this place, the King James calls it Abel Mizraim, which literally translated would mean Meadow of Egypt. And so this was place they saw, oh, how the Egyptians are grieving. And so they named it after the Egyptians. Mizraim was one of the descendants of Ham. Back, it's Noah and Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Mizraim was one of those descendants of Ham. And so that's what the Canaanites called the Egyptians. They called Egypt Mizraim instead of calling it Egypt as we do today. Now, every language has different names for the different countries, and it can get kind of confusing sometimes in these areas where you hear these different names and you go, well, what's that? Where's that? I've never heard of that place before. But a lot of times it's just the same place with a different name from a different language that was used by a different group of people. Well, it's interesting to note here that as they buried their father in that cave, as they had promised him they would, here they are, even after their father is dead, they still have respect for him and for his wants and his wishes. They still obey his last commands to them, to take him and bury him there. You know, a lot of people in our world today would have said, oh yeah, well, I promised them that because that's what they wanted to hear. I wanted them to be able to die in peace, but now that they're dead, I'm not going to go to all that much trouble. I'm not going to do all of that I said I was going to do. I'm going to just do it the cheap, easy way here, and that's their problem. That it's not a big deal. But Jacob's children did what they told him they would do. And they kept their word in this area. We could learn that. Need to be people who, if we promise something, we do it. We don't have to make promises to people. The boys didn't have to promise their father. They could have said, no, Daddy, we can't do that. We can't take you all the way back to that cave at Machpelah. We're going to have to just bury you here in Egypt. But they promised they'd do it. And when you promise you do something, you better do it. You get yourself into a lot of trouble if you don't do what you said you're going to do. So they buried him, and as far as we know, he's the last one buried in that cave. The children of Israel came back to the land of Canaan later on, some hundreds of years later. They come back. Perhaps by then the descendants had forgotten where that cave would have been located if they didn't go back there. But this is the last time that it's mentioned that anyone is buried there. So Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Leah were buried there. Maybe it was a small cave. Maybe it was full with just those. I don't know, but there was no more mention of it. No one else, even though Joseph asks for his bones to be taken out of Egypt when the children of Israel leave, and they do that. They do take his bones out. There's no mention of what they did with those bones after they took them out. There's no mention of whether they buried them in that cave or whether they took them somewhere else and buried them. We don't know what they did with them other than that they did take them out of the land of Egypt as they had said they would. Well, they all returned back to Egypt after burying Jacob. And Joseph's brothers go back to their lying ways. You know, it's bad when somebody lies on you while you're alive, but at least while you're alive and somebody lies on you, you can say, now wait a minute, I never said that. That's not true. But Jacob's sons start lying about the things he said after he's dead and he's not there to defend himself anymore. They send a message to Joseph. They're afraid that now that their father's dead, that was the only thing keeping Joseph from getting back at them for what they had done when they sold him into slavery. And so they send a messenger to him. And they send this message that Jacob said for you to forgive us. Well, Jacob never said that. In fact, as far as we know from what the scriptures record, Jacob never knew about that. He never knew that the boys had sold Joseph into slavery. So for them to play this now on Joseph and try to say, now they didn't accept, you know, Joseph had already told them a long time ago that he had forgiven them for that. And he was glad to see them, and he wanted them to come live with him, and he was going to take care of them, and he was going to feed them through the famine. I mean, if he wanted to get rid of them, the famine would have been the time to do it. Not wait till after that's all over and on years down the road and wait for their dad to die, but maybe that was the kind of thinking that they thought, you know, that's what Esau had done. Remember when Esau was upset at Jacob? And so what was he going to do? He said, well, you know, the time for mourning for my father is getting close, but after that, then I'm going to kill my brother. So maybe they thought Joseph was thinking that way, that he didn't want to do it while his father was alive, but now he's going to get back at us. He's going to kill us. He's going to put us in prison. He's going to turn us into slaves. But they come one more time. They bow down before Joseph. They offer to be his servants, to offer to be his slaves. And instead of accepting the forgiveness that he'd already given. You know, it's an amazing thing about guilt. Sometimes when we feel guilty about something, we can't forgive ourselves even if the other person has already forgiven us. Joseph has put this in the past. He's moved on. He's forgiven them for it. But here they are. They're so worried about it because they feel so guilty about what they did that they're bringing it back up. We need to watch out for that. When something's forgiven, and just put it back there. Don't keep dragging it back up. It's almost like his brothers have this desire to get Joseph to get mad at him and do something to them. That's the way they're headed. They keep bringing it up time and time again. Well, Joseph reminds them that he is not God, and he's not in the place of God to dish out judgment and to take vengeance. But he does let them know that he knew that they were trying to be evil, that they meant it for evil. They were mean. He knew that. He knew it wasn't some accident or something. He knew what they were doing, and they knew what they were doing, and he lets them know that. But he says, despite what your plans were, God had bigger plans. God's plan was to save a lot of people, and he used the wickedness to do it. And we sang this morning the song 10,000 Angels. And I think the third verse there talks about how the wicked works of man were done. But then verse 4, it talks about the wondrous plan of God was done. You know, God is so mighty, so powerful, and so knowing that He can even take wicked people's actions people who are trying to be disobedient to Him, who are being in rebellion to Him, who aren't loving Him, who aren't doing what He wants, He can take those people and take their sinful actions and turn it into something good. That's what He can do. And that's what He did with Joseph. He took those brothers meant it. They were trying to get rid of Him. That's what, and they thought they accomplished it. But they didn't know what God knew. They didn't have plans that went as far into the future as God's plans. It's an amazing thing if we look through, all through the Bible, in the Old Testament especially, leading up to the coming of Christ. Step by step, Satan is constantly working against God's plan. The problem is Satan doesn't know God's plan. And so he can't overcome it. And every step of the way, Satan thinks he's becoming victorious. But he's not. He's just stepping one step further along God's plan. When he got Adam and Eve to commit sin in the garden, I'm sure Satan thought, well, there I go. I won. I got those two people. The only two people on earth. And I got them to sin. I got them to do what I wanted them to do instead of what God wanted them to do. But he didn't win. God just put His plan into effect. When He got all of the people to be so wicked during the time of Noah that God was ready to destroy them, the whole earth with a flood, I'm sure He thought, I've got Him now. I've won. All the people are wicked. But there was Noah who found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And God saved him and moved the plan right along. And then on and on with Abraham and with Isaac and with Jacob and now, time and time again, and with Joseph here, that Satan thought he won. Thought he had this plan defeated all the way up till the point when Jesus came, you know, and he gets Herod to try to wipe out all the babies in Bethlehem. And then after that, you know, he tries to get the people to kill Jesus on two or three different occasions in various different ways. And finally, then he gets the people, they crucify Christ. They kill Him. And Satan thinks he's won the victory again. But he forgot what God told him all the way back there in Genesis chapter 3. You're going to bruise His heel, but He's going to crush your head. So Satan got people to kill Jesus and bruise His heel. Now, you wouldn't think about dying a death on a cross as a bruised heel. I mean, that seems pretty serious. But Jesus rose again and crushed Satan's power. Because the power of sin is death. Power that Satan holds over this world is the power of death. And Christ was victorious over that. Satan has no more power. We've got to realize Satan has been defeated. Sometimes I don't think we realize that. Oh, we're still fighting our battle for our lives, for our soul, but God has defeated Satan. Satan lost. Satan lost at the cross. He has no chance for victory. And all we have to do is make sure we stay on the right side. Stay on God's side because He's won. Stay on the winning side. That's all we have to do. God's plans are incredible. They're more than we could ever think or imagine, Ephesians tells us. But Joseph again comforts his brother, tells them not to be afraid. He promises he'll take care of them and their children. He won't let them die. He's going to make sure they've got food and those kinds of things. All of the Israelites, all of the children of Israel, continue to live in Egypt, and Joseph lives till he's 110. He got to see his families grow up, his sons' families grow up, all the way down to the third generation in Ephraim's line and the second generation with Manasseh's line. And then Joseph calls all of, the King James says his brethren, although there's a good chance a lot of his brothers who were older than him, Benjamin's the only one that was younger than Joseph, so a lot of his brothers probably died before he did, but that term that's translated brethren is kind of just a kinfolks. He called his family in and he said, I'm going to die. I'm about to die. And he prophesied again that God would bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. He said, God promised it to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, and God's going to do what He said. He may not, you know, didn't know when. He didn't know exactly how. He didn't know what was going to happen in the intervening years. He didn't know all the story, but he knew God said He was going to bring them up out of there to go to the land of Canaan, and he believed God was going to do what He said. And so he prophesied that, yes, God would bring them up, and He makes them promise. He makes them take an oath that when they leave out, and he told them, you know, you make sure you pass this on from generation to generation, keep so that this is known, that when you leave, you take my body up out of here, take my bones out of here, don't leave me in Egypt. Now, again, as far as we know, Joseph's the only one of the brothers who has that kind of thought process, that he didn't want to stay in Egypt. And again, it reminds us that of how much Joseph is thinking about God and about God's people. He's thinking about his extended family now that's soon going to become an entire nation. And he's thinking about it, and he doesn't want his body left there in Egypt. He wants them to take that out of there. And they do that. According to Exodus 13 and verse 19, when Moses and the children of Israel leave the land of Egypt, they took Joseph's bones with them. They took his body, what was left of it by that time. It probably would be, you know, we would consider it a mummy, his mummified remains. They took that with them when they left. Well, 110 years old, Joseph dies. They embalm him and they put him in the coffin. That's all it says about Joseph's death. Remember what we saw about Jacob's death? I mean, oh, they embalmed him for 40 days, all the 70 days of mourning by all the Egyptians, Pharaoh's household, everybody goes to the funeral, travels days to go off to another country to have the funeral. And of Joseph, it just says, he died, they embalmed him and put him in a coffin. And it makes you wonder, if already, at this point, the people of Egypt are forgetting how Joseph had saved them. Already forgetting about it. I mean, it's been, and we know Joseph was somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 when all those events with the famine were happening. So, you know, about 50, that was probably over with and done with. And don't know how much longer after that Jacob's death was, but it was still a long time before Joseph's, obviously. But here we are, some 50, 60 years later, surely some of the people that Joseph helped save were still alive. But there was no big mourning. There was no big funeral. There was doesn't seem to be any big fanfare about Joseph's death. He just died and they embalmed him. And they put him in a coffin. You know, we see how this works. We turn over and slip into Exodus just for a minute, just a few verses. And we've probably heard this before. But in verse number 8, it says, there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it comes to pass when there's a falling out with any war, they join with our enemies and fight against us. And then they get out of the land. And so they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with burdens. They enslaved the Israelites. They enslaved the people who were responsible for them still being alive. They enslaved the descendants of Joseph and his kinfolks, his family. They put them to work, made them carry burdens, set taskmasters over them to afflict them. How quickly we forget. Oh, it is amazing how quickly we can forget our heritage and our history. One man used to say, well, you know, the church is always only one generation away from apostasy or extinction. It really is. It's really not that far. It doesn't take a generation. I've seen churches go from being good congregations to being off into all sorts of false teaching in 10 years. It can happen so fast. You know, sometimes you think, well, you know, maybe years down the road when everybody's dead and gone, and it talks about that there in Exodus, that everybody that remembered Joseph died. All of those older folks that remembered what happened, they died off, and then that new Pharaoh came up, and he didn't remember Joseph. And so where the others had seen someone who had helped them and seen a friend, he saw only the danger and the threat that was there. It's happening in our society every day. A society that was built on a belief in God, a trust in the Almighty. I saw a website, a church in California has put up a website that actually has quotations from sections of the constitutions of every state in the United States. Now, some of those were written, you know, almost 200 years ago. Some of them 100 years ago. But every single one of them, they have a quote in there that says something about their trust in God or their belief in an Almighty God. Some of them that maybe are a little more nebulous, they may say something about a supreme creator or something to that effect. But every state in the United States had that in their constitution. I guess it still does. It's still on the paper. And yet look at the lives that the people in all of these states are living. And look at the things that are being pushed and taught and how the belief in God is being ridiculed and rejected by so many of these people. Only 100 years down the road. Now, I doubt that there's anybody alive today that remembers when the Constitution of Louisiana was written, but it's probably only 2 or 3 generations back. It's not that far back to where somebody could have remembered that. But the problem is that the teaching was not handed down from one generation to the next. That's what happened in Egypt. That's what happened with Joseph and the Israelites in Egypt. And that's what can happen in the church. It's what happens to us in our families. We don't pass our faith on from one generation to another. That's what happens in the church. We don't teach the next generation that's coming up how to be leaders in the church. We don't teach them about the doctrines that the church should hold. We don't teach them about Christ. We don't teach them about God. And so, instead of there being a new king rising up that doesn't know Joseph, we have in a lot of churches leadership rising up that doesn't know the Bible and that doesn't know God. That doesn't know Jesus Christ. Oh, they still call themselves Christians. But they don't know the one that they're named after, like they should. Tonight you may be here and you may be struggling with that yourself. Maybe you haven't fully gained the faith that you need to have. Maybe you're struggling in that area with faith. Maybe you've forgotten. Now, the church in Ephesus was warned to remember the things that they did back when their love was new. To remember from whence they had fallen. You know, sometimes, even though we've been Christians for years, sometimes we forget what it was like when we were still excited about being a Christian. And we've just kind of gotten into a rut and a routine with it. And there's no enthusiasm and no feeling behind it. And we need to work on that. Hebrews 2:1 tells the Christians, we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest at any time we let them slip. We've got to beware. It's so easy to let those things slip. For those who aren't Christians, there's only one way to become one. I know there, you can hear people say all sorts of things out there in the religious world, but the Bible teaches only one plan. To hear the Word of God, 2 Timothy 4:17 tells us. To believe that Word, John 8:24. To repent of sins, 2 Peter 3:9. To confess the name of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, Philippians 2:9-11. And to be buried in baptism, Acts 2:38 tells us. If you haven't done that tonight, do that before it's too late. If as a Christian you haven't been living as you should, maybe you've forgotten. Maybe you need to be put in remembrance of some of those things again. And remember from whence you've fallen. If you need to respond tonight, please do so as we stand.